Oh man.
Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your suddenly swole outlet of music, news, and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica.
Yeah, I learned a game from William Wesley, you can never check me. Back to back for the that didn't get the message. Back to back like I'm on the cover of Lethal Weapon. Back to back like I'm Jordan 96, 97, whoa. Very important and very pretentious. When I look back, I might be mad that I gave this attention. Yeah, but it's weighing heavy on my conscience. Yeah.
Is everybody charged up right now? I think you are. Whew, I'm at 100%. We were just listening to Back to Back, and if you have been paying even the slightest bit of attention to what's going on in the world of hip-hop for the last couple weeks, you know what that is. Drake's second comeback record targeting Meek Mill. It's been a busy couple weeks for Drake admirers, for Drake detractors. It's only right that we convened some Drakeophiles to get in here and just chop game. I am surrounded by two people who know a tremendous amount, and I want to welcome them. First, we have Minya O.
Hello there.
What's up, Minya?
AKA.
Why don't you tell the people the AKA?
AKA Miss Info.
Yeah, okay, all right. That's someone well-practiced. Yeah. Well-practiced in the art of radio drops. You may know Minya from Hot 97 and from MissInfo.tv.
I know
Minya from XXL Magazine, circa 1998.
And before that, Vibe and Source and a lot of.
Minya reviewed Illmatic in The Source.
Oh, gosh.
That's a lot.
That's a lot. Like, that alone.
Makes me old.
Or you should probably be hosting, to be honest.
No.
So anyway, you know, Minya's here, and we're very grateful that Minya's here. And to Minya's right, we have Rawia Kamir.
Hi, how you doing?
How you doing?
Good.
Rawia is here from The Fader and from The Six. Rawia and I were both at OVO Fest.
Indeed, we were.
I know Minya would have liked to have been there.
I would have loved to have been there, but...
I was too busy flexing. Yeah. So it's like,
as she does.
Yeah, it's like a lot of...
With my two-month-old baby.
It's a full-time job. Full-time flex. Let's talk a little bit about OVO Fest. I wrote a piece about OVO Fest. You wrote about OVO Fest. You detailed all the things on your website that happened.
Oh, I had so much FOMO. Yeah.
There was a lot. I can imagine. I was thinking initially, like, so Drake, Meek Mill, maybe this is over. Like, maybe it's done. You know, he put out Charged Up and then Back to Back, and Meek put out a song whose name I do not even know the name of.
Oh, wanna know.
Cool. That's okay. If you say so. Like, I'm not even gonna Google that. Like, if you tell me that's what it is. And there's part of me that's like, maybe that's it. Like, cool. Like, OVO Fest will just be some weird standalone thing. It will demonstrate its power by ignoring the entire beef. Yeah, and that didn't happen. So just to detail what did happen, and then we'll start talking about why. As you guys likely know, a few hours before the show, Drake was photographed backstage wearing the OG Free Meek Mill t-shirt when Meek Mill had the braids, which Drake had worn last year when Meek was actually in jail. And then the first 10 minutes of the show were basically a very systematic, very cruel, and maybe slightly gloaty dissection of Meek Mill antagonism. Drake played Charge Up, and then he played Back to Back, and behind him on a screen, they just pilfered about 50 memes from the internet of Meek looking silly. And
in a PowerPoint presentation.
Great slideshow. Seriously. Did you sell ads against that?
I mean,
you make so much money.
It was great. The internet is wonderful.
And it sort of, I thought it was fitting, given that it was this beef started on the internet, which is like not Meek Mill's home turf. It's like starting a fight with a guy in Tampa or something.
Right.
It's like you don't. I don't know what's going on in Tampa. Like, I don't want to get involved in that. Meek came to Drake's turf, which is the internet, basically, and started a fight. And Drake was like, "Oh, you want the internet? Okay, yeah, I got some internet for you." When you saw that go up on the screen, were your eyes popping out of your head?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, the thing is, Drake is really good at the internet, and he loves the internet. But he doesn't like to claim it, right? He likes to have this sort of distance from it that I think he thinks insulates him a little bit from the way that people talk about him. But at the end of the day, Drake is a very petty guy, and he's a hilarious guy. So what happened on that screen was like the intersection of those two things. Mm-hmm. And I think he knew what he was doing. His strategy is always on point, and that's he drove the message all the way home.
He is sort of like his own response system. Like, he knows everything that's said about it. And it's like, it is the Eminem thing in a way. It's like, you can't say something about me that I haven't said or thought of or factored into my own being. But at the same time, he's good at doing it to the other person as well. Like, it's not just about protecting Drake.
Yeah.
He is now capable of, like, flipping it.
Exactly.
On a person.
So in Back to Back, the line where he describes himself as a singing N-word is, you know, he's acknowledging what the one thing that Meek Mill has to say about him, but flipping it against Meek, which, you know, it's like I feel like the memes were a physical representation of that exact line. It's
totally true. Tremendous, tremendous line.
I mean, I think we're basically in a generation and in a time where everybody is so hyper aware, self-aware of themselves that they can use all of those things both for them, against them. Everything is just a vehicle for whatever your hashtag mood is, right? Mm-hmm. So it's weird, but this past couple weeks has felt like the perfect storm of everything that is 2015. So there was Petty Wop.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
There was In Your Feelings. Mm-hmm. There was memes and merchandise. You know, there were t-shirts being sold.
So,
there was
so fast.
Shade. Mm-hmm. Everything was mm-hmm. all like in this one kind of beef. I think that that definitely speaks to Drake. Like, you kind of get the sense that, yes, Meek started it on Twitter, but it was on his phone. And you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Whereas Drake.
Not an unimportant fact.
Yeah.
Right. Where Drake was, you know, had all the access to Tumblr and Instagram and.
And a creative team.
Yeah. Like
I mean,
a whole exactly. team of like very internet literate people.
Who know how to do. I mean, they know how to do
trending
that. Like, they haven't had
topics
to fight. Yeah. They haven't had to
yeah.
fight anyone, but yeah. like it's just using the same tools that they use all the time for this purpose.
Yeah.
And it was, I forget, someone was tweeting basically like. Like Meek Mill is basically fighting alone, and Drake is kind of like, "Oh no, no, no! We do like
right.
we collectively do this.
Me and my trolls,
right,
are
like,
all here.
Right, we're all here. And so, like, you can sort of like bark all you want, but like, we're always gonna be two steps ahead, and we're always gonna be more organized, and we're always gonna be more efficient.
Yeah.
I mean, you literally have Meek Mill tweeting like baby lotion's off, and then Drake makes a T-shirt and sells it for $40.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Like, those are not the same. Like, that's you're not fighting. That's like literally David and Goliath.
Yeah.
They're literally there's no commonality between those two foes. Which I think begs the question that we should really talk about, which is, why did Meek Mill pick this fight? How did it take so long for someone of any note to go at Drake?
You know, it could have been anybody, really. I think a beef was imminent, whether it was going to be Meek Mill or somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
But Meek was coming off a very strong moment where he had, you know, his first week sales were really high.
Mm-hmm.
He's in Us Weekly all of a sudden.
Mm-hmm.
He's dating Nicki Minaj.
Yep.
People know who he is. And to a certain degree, I think he's a bit insulated from, you know, the realities of the pop world.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, Meek is a guy who, you know, hip-hop literally saved his life. It's a cliche, but for mm-hmm. him, that's literally what happened. If he wasn't a guy who could write raps as good as he does, you know, who knows what he would have been up
sure.
to, right? So I understand why, to him, it was such a personal situation. On the other hand, you know, their lives are so interconnected personally, aside from the industry, that who knows what really instigated it, right? The tweet started with Safari, who's Nicki Minaj's ex. So it could have been something a bit deeper than just the ghostwriting situation.
Mm.
I think
Misinfo just for this particular section.
I know, because this is where, you know, in every conversation, I kind of either shut up because there's just way it goes so deep,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, if you sort of get into the more celebrity drama aspects of it, I think that Meek also hints at that. So even when he started this beef, he alluded to things like, I needed to show someone something,
mm-hmm.
you know, that I have no chill. I mean, those were clear signs to me that this was also sort of a lover's quarrel between him and Nicki. And I think that there's a lot that happens behind the scenes.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, we hear about it later on when people reveal them in, you know, podcasts or whatever. But with these two very volatile, very successful artists, Nicki and Meek, you know, who knows what kind of catfights are happening
mm-hmm.
behind the scenes. They're on tour together. My God, it's like being locked in a room with
mm-hmm.
your significant other. And I also think that there's a lot of macho sort of chest thumping that might be happening between Meek and Drake
mm-hmm.
because of the relationship between Nicki and Drake.
Right, whatever
and
that might be.
Specifically, because of lyrics that Drake has
well, sure.
said,
mm-hmm.
Where he's kind of referenced lusting after Nicki. And, you know, maybe Meek felt like Drake even subbed him on his own song by saying that, you know, the girl of your dreams is,
mm-hmm.
you know, nothing that special to me.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there was a lot that was happening, bubbling for a long time. And from what I hear, there have been tons and tons of subs going back and forth. So only now did it sort of bubble up and spill over, but it was waiting
mm-hmm.
to happen. It's the only thing, though, is that maybe the tool that Meek used he pulled out like the only gun that you can really use against Drake, but didn't necessarily aim it.
Yeah, yeah. It like got stuck.
Jammed.
Yeah. Yeah, it got jammed. We're definitely syndicating this podcast on the Shade Room. Just out loud, we just went in.
Cool.
Yeah. Sarah, real talk. So given that, and also I think a thing that's worth mentioning on top of what you just said about Meek is Meek is quite literally like the last of a breed. A street rapper with, I don't want to say tremendous commercial potential, but some commercial potential, signed to a major label. Literally, we could probably name them on one hand. There's not a lot of them. When I was thinking about the beef, I have like a very clear memory of many years ago, Funk Flex being on the radio talking about, I'm forgetting who was beefing with Craig G at the time. It was like, this is when, number one, someone was beefing with Craig G. Number two, Funk Flex was talking about it.
Okay.
So like, this was like, what, 1812? Like, this was a long time ago. But Flex said like, oh, so, you know, dude thought Craig G was a biscuit. That's like an actual thing Funk Flex said.
We need to bring back biscuit.
Yeah, we just did.
Yeah, okay.
We literally just did. So just everybody take it home. You know, everybody's listening. Take it to your hometowns. It's popping now. In addition to all the subs and in addition to the sexual issues, in addition to the potential sexual issues, in addition to the behind the scenes drama between Nicki and Meek, I think Meek thinks Drake is a biscuit. And he was like, he ain't going to say nothing. He's not going to say a damn thing.
Right.
And so he took the shot thinking that everybody would rally around him, number one, and that Drake would cower. What Meek didn't understand is like you could sell 180,000 records in your first week, but you are 1/12 as popular as Drake
right.
in 2015. And the thing that you're obsessed with, the people who care about are not contemporary mainstream rap fans. They're backpack kids. They buy Duck Down records, you know, like it's those people. But on a fundamental level, Drake fans, generally speaking, are not like, what? You know, they don't even know that the sort of mechanics of how those songs get made.
Right.
So it's like two steps too far kind of for the average Drake fan to process.
It's something that they don't care about. It's not the organic or the GMO. Those aren't the the red flag issues for this generation in
exactly.
terms of rap. It's not about 15, 20 years ago, it would have been like calling somebody a biter.
Yes.
Or calling someone gay, God forbid.
Right.
Now, the kids don't care about any of those things.
Right. Which is, in some level, it's a testament to the mainstreaming of hip-hop in
right.
the sense that so many people participated in so many different ways and to such varying degrees that the rule set, which used to be defined and enforced by a small cabal of people, of which Minya was one. But no, you know, it used to be like literally like the Coalition and the Illuminati.
Yeah.
Like you just sort of, this is just what rap
the
is.
Elements.
Right,
the
exactly.
Elements,
you're in a KRS-One would call you and tell you if you were in hip hop or not.
Yeah.
You would just get these calls at like 3 a.m. and it'd be like, you are no longer hip hop. You'd be like,
right.
what did I do? Like literally.
How did I get my number?
Yes, it's weird. Like, what did I do? So at a point, that's what it was like. But now it's not like that anymore. Like my version of what hip hop is not what yours is, not what yours is. And it's certainly not what some 14-year-old kid in like Oklahoma's is.
Yeah.
Meek, in some weird way, thought when he sort of like valiantly stood up for the rules and was like, I'm the ethics police now. Everybody's going to be like, oh, damn, we've been waiting for that. And it turned out like literally no person was waiting for that. Like not a one.
Whereas people would have been waiting for that if it was all depending on who the opponent was. So to your point, Drake's fans are ones who do not care about those things, but also have all of the skills and the know-how to spread their opinion wider, right?
Mm-hmm.
So their reaction is to clown Meek, and they know how to SEO it.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, so that spreads like wildfire. Whereas when it's Meek versus, say, Cassidy, this is like a battle that Meek clearly destroys Cassidy and uses a lot of the same techniques, you know, like aggression, idle violent threats that are just par for the course in hip hop, and a lot of personal sort of hurtful
facts,
jabs.
Like, just weird obscure stuff, like obscure Philly stuff that like
totally.
Six people know. And,
well, you know, what's crazy is that, you know, in the Meek Cassidy beef, you know, he even brought up A.R. Ab.
Yep.
Okay. So this is like basically Philly's boogeyman.
Mm-hmm.
A super thug.
Former Meek affiliate, now no longer. Former Dream Chasers affiliate, now no longer. And maybe OVO.
Maybe OVO. So all it took was just
TV
a photo. Of, you know, so Drake then uses that exact same person who is this mythological creature in Philly folklore, and mentions him in his song. And then suddenly you see a photo of him and he's talking about OVO, and it's like, oh, now everything has gone haywire. I mean, Drake, at the show that you guys were at, brought out Will Smith. So that's supposed to also be another jab, because Will Smith is obviously from Philly. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if you really break down that move, what does that even mean? Like, what does Will Smith mean to the battle?
In 2015, Will Smith is from L.A.
Right.
You know, like, and that's what it comes down to.
Should have brought out Jaden.
Yeah, exactly.
If he brought out Will, I'd have been turned. Yeah. Are you kidding me?
But if he had brought out Beanie Siegel, then that to me means something.
Exactly.
I actually had like a weird like fever dream before I got on the plane where I was like, oh my God, it's going to be Young Chris. It's going to be Siegel. It's going to be Freeway. Right. It's going to be Cassidy. Like, it's literally just going to be like 30 minutes of Philly street rap.
And I mean,
it's
those,
be amazing.
Those rumors are going around. Like, up until like an hour before the show, I heard all kinds of things. I heard The Undertaker was coming. You know, I definitely heard Beanie Siegel was coming. But I think, you know, more to your point earlier, I think the ghostwriting situation, I think the timing was just off. If this had happened when Nothing Was the Same came out, it would have been a bigger deal.
I agree.
But with, you know, with the new record, Drake has fully crossed over into pop. And he, the fact that he has these songwriting credits on the album kind of insulates him from the fact that he might be using ghostwriters that aren't credited elsewhere, right? Hmm. So he's now on a completely different level. He's on a Rihanna, Beyonce sort of level. And people are going to be looking at him in the sense that, you know, if the song is good, that's what matters. Doesn't matter if Sia wrote it. Doesn't matter if Quentin Miller wrote it, as long as it's on the radio and people like it.
But do you feel like that's true, even though what, John, you sort of talked about in your piece was that this latest mixtape album is more aggressive and street?
Which is exactly what I was about to say, which is it's interesting. And this is where I think we have to start talking about, you know, new Drake versus old Drake.
Mm-hmm.
Or I think maybe when I wrote about Nothing Would Say, it was like tough Drake. You know, like this is swole Drake.
Yeah.
So let's talk about swole Drake. And I don't mean that purely about physicality, although, like, obviously when he put those photos out, there was a
moment.
That was a thing. You know, he was trying to show you something, and people were trying to see it. So that's one thing. But that, like, swole Drake, literal physical swole Drake, coincides with lyrically swole Drake.
Right.
I mean, you know, if you're reading this as a fight record, basically, and if you listen to Take Care, or Comeback Season, would you ever think that that guy would basically put out a fight album?
But
you wouldn't
you,
think that.
Would you ever think that that guy would go from being this random kid from Toronto who was once on Degrassi to being literally the most popular rapper on the planet? I think the fact that it's perceived as a fight record is more of a reflection of the fact that he achieved what to many of us, especially people from Toronto, was impossible. And he's like our king now, you know? And I don't think it's necessarily a reflection of his personal sort of status, but more so where his career is at. And he had no choice but to do that, I think.
But he doesn't seem just like a coincidence to you. I mean, it seems like way more than a coincidence to me that physically tough, lyrically tough. You know, 5 years ago, he was like, diss me, you'll never hear a reply for it. And now he's like, oh, you got something?
Oh, yeah.
We got
now,
the shooters.
I think now he knows he's untouchable, right? And he's untouchable in the musical sense. But that's also why he's all of a sudden bigging up these guys that are around him that have sort of street cred or whatever, for better or worse, mostly for worse. You know, it's not a coincidence at all. It's, in fact, I think part of the larger strategy. But it's something that a few years ago he would have been too afraid to do because he was scared of losing. Now he knows he can't lose.
Right. Although I wonder at the same time, you know, if there was a problem that you could have had with, if you're reading this.
Yeah.
It's the sort of suspension of disbelief problem.
The authenticity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's like, it's like I've enjoyed Drake for X amount of years for these 10 things, of which two are on this album and the other eight have been swapped out for their polar opposite.
Right.
Doesn't mean that they're bad records. It's just a question of, do you accept conceptually records of that nature from a guy like Drake? That's the only, in my mind, the only real open question about that album.
And I think what it comes down to is the sort of the same reason that people don't have a problem with him using ghostwriters, which is that people have disconnected who he is from the music that they like. So authenticity in hip hop has always been, you know, central to the genre. But I think we're at a point now when, you know, I'm not really thinking about Drake particularly as a rapper. And it's sort of like what 40 said in his perfectly crafted response to Meek Mill, which is that Drake is more than a rapper at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I understand why in certain circles that would discredit his status as a rapper. But ultimately, you know, Drake is on a Will Smith path.
But this album is literally the most rapper stuff he's ever, like, literally, it is the most capital R rapper stuff that he's done. Like
that
his whole career.
He might not have felt comfortable to make if
exactly.
he had felt, if he didn't feel like, I am now past reproach.
Exactly.
Right. You know, so whereas before, I think that the thing that I appreciate about Drake the most is that he both is willing to be the joke for
yes.
some people.
Mm-hmm.
Like he's willing to accept that because that also makes him popular. And he's also willing to make the joke. I mean, he's just all things for all people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, obviously this whole topic has been, you know, we've been talking about it with pretty much everybody we know, every
mm-hmm.
dinner conversation,
mm-hmm.
every day online. And some smarter people than me have definitely pointed out that he actually got past, despite Degrassi,
mm-hmm.
despite Canada, despite
mm-hmm.
all of these things, the way that he looks, the way that he talks, by sort of aligning himself with street and
mm-hmm.
legitimacy,
mm-hmm.
whether it was like, you know, James Prince or
mm-hmm.
whether it was
getting on a Future record in 2011
Weezy,
or
right.
Wayne, you know, like, yeah,
exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So if we kind of like allowed him in, you know, that's a messed up thing to say, but if we allowed him in,
see, you are in the Illuminati.
Right?
I knew it,
because
yeah.
the bottom
mm-hmm.
line is just, mm-hmm. despite all those things, he's also such a good MC.
Mm-hmm.
Then that's when those people are like, oh, but wait a second
mm-hmm.
now.
I remember
I used to
have to argue with people. They'd be like, Drake can't rap. And I was like, what are you, like, literally?
Yeah,
or is this like, I was having
incredible.
That conversation.
Yeah.
Like, as recently as, like, 2013.
Yeah.
People were like, yeah, Drake's a bad rapper.
And I mean,
was like, what? Literally, what are you talking
about?
It's like,
about? People like to discredit Drake's street cred or whatever, which is completely valid. But I think a lot of that has to do with perceptions about class and race.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you take somebody like Rick Ross, who, you know,
yeah.
he's a fraud. But he doesn't get questioned for those kinds of things because of who he is or what he looks like and where he comes from, right?
Or we've just let it go. Like,
we've let it go,
yeah. Let everything go.
Exactly. Right. So, but Drake is an easy target.
Yes, although here is a radical idea that I have not yet put in a piece, but I will put in this podcast,
mm-hmm.
which is Drake actually is the perfect antidote to Rick Ross. Here's why. Rick Ross basically completely exploded the idea of authenticity
mm-hmm.
and still he's still successful, but he basically completely took that concept out in the back and shot it. Drake was like, oh, no, I have authenticity. It's a completely different sort of authenticity. The subject matter is different. The
yeah.
framing is different. The sound is different, but it's true.
Yeah.
Drake saved authenticity. In my mind, Drake saved authenticity. And if there's any reason to be sort of shocked by the Meek Mill thing, the
mm-hmm.
what Meek Mill brings up, it's that, you know, like if I found out that Drake didn't write Marvin's Room,
yeah.
I'm gonna cry.
Yeah.
Like that's, I mean, I'm literally wearing a shirt with Drake lyrics on.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like, shouts to Grace, by the way.
Yeah.
It's, you know, like this is part of Drake's sales pitch was quietly to kind of undermine hip hop's slow slide away from conceptions of authenticity. And I don't think enough people are really talking about that, that actually was part of the Drake value proposition. So even though hip-hop heads,
mm-hmm.
like OG guys, are going to say, well, Drake not writing his lyrics is a problem because of hip-hop rules, in my mind, if it's a problem at all, it's a problem because of the other thing. It's a problem because we really
we're living a lie the whole time.
Right,
yeah.
We signed on for the thing.
Right.
And so, and again, we just don't know.
Yeah. I think, too, though, that Drake, again, it's really easy to call his authenticity into question, but I think he represents a sort of larger Toronto cultural context that a lot of people don't necessarily understand, which is that until more recently, the gap between the middle, the sort of upper class and the lower class in Toronto was not as stark as it is in a lot of places in the States where we're used to, you know, where the sort of the most popular rappers emerge from. So someone like Drake, who is, you know, his family grew up lower middle class in Toronto, he was close to a lot of the things that he raps about, and it's very easy for him to have slid into these dark
mobility.
Corners of East Toronto, where
mm-hmm.
he was in fact close to shooters and he
yeah.
was running phone scams or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not that, you know, he's never going to catch a body, but it's not that it's a complete lie. It's not like he's sitting, you know, in a beautiful house in Forest Hill making up these stories. It's just that who the actor is a bit more fluid.
It's blurry, basically.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
you know, but if anybody, you know, anybody that really, really listens to hip hop, they can understand that it's not the person who, it's not the shooters who can always tell the story.
Oh,
the
of course.
Best,
exactly.
Right? So,
no, of course.
You know,
I mean, it's
the same
Nas,
way.
It's the Nas problem.
Exactly.
Yeah,
yeah,
sitting, watching outside your
mm-hmm.
your project window what's
mm-hmm.
happening and then telling everybody else
mm-hmm.
and being, you know, being the storyteller. So for Drake to do that, and also for all of his fans to also sort of relate to the same angst or the same drama or emotional roller coasters that somebody who is living a super thug life goes through. They're doing it on their own, like, micro level. I think that it's really interesting to think about, what does authenticity mean anymore?
Right, in 2015, like, it's...
We've forgiven everything in this relationship.
And it's also worth pointing out, I think, that those debates were really happening in a time period when major label rap, whatever that umbrella is, but major label rap was street rap. It was it was gangster and post-gangster rap. Major label rap in 2015 is Kid Ink.
Yeah.
It's Drake, but it's Kid Ink. It's Flo, like, it's Pitbull. Yeah. It's Flo Rida. It's, and that's not to say that, like, street-oriented dudes don't get deals, but it's not like it was. I mean, you know, obviously Young Thug is on 300, and you have Fetty and guys like that, but generally speaking, what exists in a major label rap context, and by extension in a radio rap context, those guys aren't playing by the same rules as what the rappers of the mid-90s were doing.
Yeah.
So for Meek to show up and sort of be like, I'm going to impose, like, hip-hop Sharia law.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like, that's nuts. It's literally nuts.
Yeah.
Okay, so given what we've been talking about sort of what constitutes truth value in hip-hop and also what constitutes truth value in Drake, let's listen to Know Yourself from If You're Reading This.
I don't like how serious they take themselves. I've always been me, I guess I know myself. Shakiness, man, I don't have no time for that. My city too turned up, I'll take a fine for that. That's been where you find me at. That's been where you find me at. I know a named Johnny Blink. He put me on a Definer Things. Had a job selling Jabo jeans. I had a yellow Techno Marine. Then Kanye dropped it with polos and backpacks.
Man. Okay, so that was Know Yourself by Drake, Aubrey Graham. Or was it?
Because that's one of the songs that a reference track leaked out for.
Mm-hmm. Talk us through it.
There's a couple songs. There's Rico, 10 Bands, Know Yourself, and a reference track, which is basically Quentin Miller voicing the lyrics that you hear Drake actually spit on the official versions of those songs.
Right. And I think each of the reference tracks, to me, has like a slightly different percent of overlap. Like,
right.
Some are like 80 to 90. There's one, I forget, maybe it's the Rico one, where it's like 20 or 30. Like,
we get like a little taste. Who knows how much more collaboration preceded that reference track or came afterwards.
Exactly.
Right. That's okay. So you want to talk us through what reference tracks are for those who don't know?
Historically, let's say Cameron writes Crush on You for Lil C's and Lil Kim. It's not enough to just actually say the rhyme. I mean, write down the rhyme and send over the lyrics. Mm-hmm. You also want to record it so that all of the cadence is right, the flow is right, the sing-song melodies are right, and it sounds exactly like you envisioned it in your head. So that's what actually leaked, and that was kind of the thing that everybody was waiting for to sort of prove this beef had merit. And so there were three tracks, reference tracks, just bits of them. And it's definitely Quentin Miller saying the rhymes that you end up hearing Drake say.
But what we don't know, in the same way that, like, you know, this isn't DNA evidence.
Yep.
This is what we don't know is at what point in the recording process those tracks came from. We don't know if Quentin Miller was provided with a verse that was 80% complete.
Yeah, skeleton.
And said, hey, go fill in the holes, like wrap the whole thing with how you would fill in the holes. Or we don't know if Quentin Miller just went in his iPhone and wrote out a verse and just wrapped it. We have no idea. And I suspect it will be some time before we have some idea. But this is sort of a dirty little secret in the hip-hop industry. Like, you know, I've been in various studios with all kinds of people. If I'm in a studio with a pop singer and a pop songwriter, you know, you have a top line person. You have the song, like, two or three songwriters throwing ideas around. Like, there is absolutely no pretense of one person, even if it's just one songwriter. There's no pretense of one person being like, I wrote this thing. It is implicitly a group effort. Many major label, big budget records, rap included, those records are made in similar fashion. I mean, there are rappers you have writing camps for pop singers. There are writing camps for rap albums. And that's because they need someone to come in and write a hook, and they need someone to come in and throw concepts around, and da da da. I mean, okay, so you think about the Tinashe record, and that Tinashe record, obviously we all identify as a Tinashe record, but that record, best I can tell, was basically delivered in a complete package from Mustard and from the songwriting team. And Tinashe showed up and was like, cool. Like, I interviewed Max Martin, Savin, who's one of Max Martin's writers recently for that weekend piece that I wrote. And he basically was just sort of like, yeah, people just show up. Like, we write the songs, and, like, people show up, and they sing them. And he's like, that's not what happened with Abel, but, like, that's how this goes. And that's totally accepted in all these other worlds. But rap, as we have seen many, many times, and certainly in the last few weeks, the rules are very different. A thing that happened recently, and Aminu, you should talk a little bit about this, there are many ways that people can steal from others or be perceived as biting. There was the Ghostface Action Bronson thing that happened recently. You want to give a quick recap of what's at stake there?
I think that Action Bronson just got caught by sort of like a troll interview on ESPN where they asked him about how much he sounds like Ghostface. And, you know, I don't think that he meant it to be this huge affront to Ghost, but he basically said, you know, Ghost isn't rapping like me now. In so many words.
Yeah, he's not rapping like this anymore.
He's not rapping like this anymore. So the inference there was that, yes, I do have some similarities in my sound, but I'm really doing great right now, and maybe he is not, right? And, you know, obviously everybody went crazy, and they built it up into this huge thing, and Ghost is not a 2015
kind of
dude. No. Yeah, so he, in the most, like, amazing way ever.
Beautiful.
My favorites, like, if that was a song, that video that he made, that's my number one song.
He made a response video.
I definitely ripped that MP3, and I have it.
Oh, I should do that. I should do that. Okay. Yeah.
What was the key line I gave you?
Oh, like, I let you, or, like, I gave you a grace period.
I gave you a grace period. And have a great summer.
I hope you have a great summer. I got the tour schedule.
Greatest threat in the history of rap. So good.
Which, you know, I think that the reason why it's a great threat and not one where we're like, let's not have, you know, East Coast, West Coast beef again, or let's not bring up the ghosts of Biggie and Pac, you know, I don't think people felt like that, because it was just sort of like, I'm going to blast you on this YouTube and I'm going to play, you know, old soul music in the background. But the whole issue, though, was like influence
of
sound. Of
like the idea. And in my reading, like, I don't have access to, like, Bronson demos from age 12. But, like, basically as far back as I've listened to Bronson, he's basically always sounded like this. And he doesn't sound like a guy who's sometimes you hear someone rap and they don't sound like they do when they talk. Like, that's sort of basically how Bronson sounds like when he's talking.
Yeah.
It's just the sped up rhythmic version of it. So in a weird way, it's a strange thing to quibble about, because if that is just his natural voice, and he does happen to have, like, intricate, complex, polysyllabic rhymes like Ghostface.
But it's performative, right? It's just, like, to what extent is it this is the way he sounds, and to what extent is it, you know,
he's fitting into a pre-existing
mold
that is out there. Totally fair. Yeah, I mean, it could go either
that,
way.
And that if he weren't a white guy with a beard, with a chef back, with this interesting background, like, he wouldn't get away with it.
You on with no shoes in the club.
Could hear a Ghost saying that, you know, back in the day.
Better than the Sean Clettis line.
Yeah.
It's so good.
But the other option is like, okay, there was like Shine back in the day. Everybody said that he sounded like Biggie. Mm-hmm. But then after you kept listening to Shine, you're like, oh, no. Mm-hmm. The voice is similar, but you're not. Your style is completely different.
Yeah, the
you're
rhythms
not,
are different. Right, the cadences are different. Well, then let's sort of expand the conversation a little bit. And let's talk about ghostwriting. Because obviously what started this whole thing, apart from all the weird Shade Room stuff that we were getting into earlier.
Yeah, the memes and all that.
Yes. Apart from that, what started this is this accusation that Drake uses ghostwriters, or given that they're credited, maybe collaborates with writers. If I were to ask you guys to distill down the thing that Drake is best at, forget the Quentin Miller thing for a sec. What is the aspect of his art that you think he's best at? Is it lyricism? Is it melody? Is it structure? Is it relatability? Like, what is the thing?
You talked about authenticity, and I think that he is the most authentic at communicating the emotional state of young people today.
Okay.
Which is, I'm locked in a room, I just talked to my computer, And these are all of the emotions that are going through my head because I have lots of hormones and I'm very lonely or I'm very excited and I don't know how to handle myself. And now I'm feeling tough and now I'm feeling very vulnerable. Like, I think those are all things that he is the most authentic at communicating.
So he's capturing an emotional generational moment.
Yes,
he's capturing a generational
moment. The emo generation, which is like probably the same as, you know, the way G-Rap was able to communicate like the anger of his era.
What do you think, Robbie?
I mean, I think the best thing, like the thing Drake is best at is like sort of leaning in, right? So whether it is an emo thing and he's talking about his ex-girlfriend on Marvin's Room, or he's, you know, talking about, or on Legend and he's talking about all these like fictional enemies that he has. What, you know, and he's fundamentally an actor. That's how he started. So everything he does is believable if you separate it from his biography. And he does it in a way that, you know, they're like little tweets. Everything is a little tweet, right? So every line is 140 characters worth of emotion or anger or whatever that may be. So it sticks with you. And the melody, of course, is a big part of that. But everything is just so succinct. And whether it's him or Quentin Miller or whoever it is, it just is relayed in a way that's like really sticky. And I think that's probably the one thing that he'll be best remembered for.
The catchiness of everything.
Yeah, like everything is an Instagram caption, but you also know what it sounds like separated from the lyrics because of the melody.
Yeah, a very sus writer once wrote, "Drake is all the emoji."
I wonder who that could have been.
I wonder who that was. I don't know, some weird guy. It's notable that none of us said lyrics as the thing that Drake is best at. That's not the thing that jumped to anybody's mind.
I mean, that's part of it, though. It's
part of it, but it's not like bars.
Yeah.
Hashtag bars. You know, given that, I have to wonder, in the big picture, whether this actually matters. Because if Drake's whole ethic is like, I'm creating a mood, I'm leaning in, I'm telling a story, well, then sure, if the most effective path towards me doing those things is that Jello brought the juice and Quentin brought the bars, then okay, maybe that's not a problem. I'm not convinced that that's the case, but it's a potential argument. However, Drake is a rapper. He's a rapper first. He's a singing rapper. He's a Canadian rapper. He has a lot of qualifiers, but he's a rapper first. And there is still, as I said before, there's rap surreal. You know, there's conservative. What is the thing that Robbie from Uncut has, the conservative rap coalition or whatever? Like, that is a very real sub-movement that still exists. Let's talk, though, about the fact that if you're mad at Drake, who else do you have to be mad at?
Yeah.
You have to be mad at Dr. Dre. You have to be mad at Nas. You have to be mad at Snoop. You have to be mad at Puff. You got to be mad at Eazy-E. Hip-hop's original sin is maybe Rapper's Delight. And
Grandmaster Kaz.
Kaz's rhyme book basically just stolen straight out of the book. So this has always been there. And that's not to say that people accept it because it's always been there. But even the people who I think Meek thinks would be on his side certainly have to like look in the mirror and be like, well, I get this other guy and he didn't write such and such. So what role has ghostwriting played? When was it the biggest problem, do you think? And how does it feel now in the genre compared to how it was, say, in the 80s or 90s? Minya.
I think the two biggest examples of that everybody wants to talk about is like Dr. Dre and Puff. But they're people that didn't start out as – you just said that like Drake is first and foremost a rapper. Dre is definitely not first and foremost a rapper. No. Neither was Puff. And Puff is always – cop to, like, I write checks. You know, I don't write rhymes. And Dre,
can you imagine if that lyric dropped in the Think Piece era? Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Internet shut down.
But it was genius because it's true and it keeps, and it's
great.
And
it's unassailable.
Every reason. Right. But, like, with Dre, I kind of, and actually with both of those guys, you almost feel like it's like a really rich benefactor commissioning portraits.
Interesting.
I love Rakim. I want him to paint me a portrait. So, hey, Rakim, tell me about myself, you know, or hey, Nas. And so if you were like, you know, if I was a producer, a super producer, and I was making a compilation album, of course, I would want to get all of these people. Tell me about myself.
Or even like being styled by someone. Like Rick Owens shows up and like dresses
make
you.
Make me cooler.
Yeah.
Totally.
I remember I interviewed Bun B a bunch of years ago, and we were talking about he would do features, and he was like, well, sometimes the people I'm doing the feature with, and these like no-name local guys, mm-hmm. will ask me to write a rhyme for them. And he's like, I'll do it, but it sounds terrible. And he's like, that's not what it's about. He's like, it's how do you carry it? How do you swing the syllables? How do you present? He's like, that's probably as or more important than whatever words. He's like, if you have the other part, you can write bad words.
Yeah,
because exactly. It sounds cool.
Yeah.
But if you don't have that part, I can't kind of do anything for you.
If you look at somebody like Sauce Money, mm-hmm. Who wrote I'll Be Missing You.
And who also tweeted at Drake, talk that, king.
Oh, God. All the people who jumped in, like, Kia Shine, like, it was, mm-hmm. there was so much extra.
But Sauce was on Drake's, but like, notably, Sauce was on Drake's side.
Right.
That, I was like.
Kind of had to be, though.
Of course, yeah. But also he's from that era where he could kind of could have gone the other way. Because, like, there's a difference between, like, writing for Puff and writing for Big.
Right.
True. You know what I mean? Like,
but so with Sauce and with that song, obviously that was the most personal song for Puff. Mm-hmm. But Sauce, from what I understand, was able to kind of pull from his emotional well, talking about loss.
Yeah, because his mother passed.
Losing his mom, then he was able to step into Puffy's shoes and write something that applied. Mm-hmm. Then there's times when it goes totally wrong and it just sounds like you're a cover band, like when he did Pharoah Monch's rhymes. Puffy delivering a Pharoah Monch lyric is horrid.
Also, literally just demonstrates Pharoah Monch should not be a ghostwriter.
Yeah,
like,
right.
Like, part of being a ghostwriter is being a ghost.
Yeah.
Like,
well,
you
that's the
be
hubris
able, right,
of
that's,
Puffy to ask him to do that. Like, yo, you're an incredible MC. Can I wear your shoes today?
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so, there's so many different ways that can go. But I think that with those two, it was more about, I'm making an album. I want the best of the best. All the people that I really like to listen to. And, like, Dre does that with whoever he now likes. So that's Kendrick.
Yeah, it's Eminem. It's Kendrick.
Right.
It's Cube at one point. Like, totally. Jay. It's Jay. Is that, like, 100% the Jay thing, the still Dre? It's 100%.
It's got to be. Yeah, everybody knows that.
Does he have publishing on that record? I feel like I looked at some point, maybe he had publishing on that record.
I don't know, but I know that, like, for some people who are known as ghostwriters, it's an endless curse that, you're basically wearing a scarlet letter for the rest of your life. And nobody wants you to win from there on out because you know where the bodies are.
Sure.
And,
yeah.
And it's like kind of sad for someone like even like Skills. He can write lots of rhymes, but mm-hmm. people are going to listen the most when he is angry about not getting paid for his ghostwriting work and writing a song called Ghostwriter.
Yeah.
I would really advise you to pay your ghostwriters just if you're going to use ghostwriters.
Just as a starting point.
Yeah. Like that's if you don't want your business on Front Street.
So which kind of makes you wonder, how did this all get to Front Street with Drake?
So you're saying who's really mad? Like is it Meek or is it Quentin?
Quentin.
And just as a sidebar.
Yeah.
Best I can tell, Quentin Miller was in Atlanta this weekend. This past weekend, he was not in Toronto. I saw someone put a short video of him, and it seemed that they were in Atlanta, but I can't, 100% swear that.
Yeah.
And so, if that's the case, why wasn't Quentin Miller mobbing with Mandem at the end of the show?
Because, I mean, other dudes who have songwriting credits on the album were in Toronto, and I saw them all, right?
Tell us who, Raleigh.
I mean, Amir Obi, who definitely has songwriting credits mm-hmm. and who's mm-hmm. been, open about it.
Mm-hmm.
Was definitely at OVO having the time of his life, which
Robbie
is great.
I want that page six of the six. I want to know all the details.
But I mean, but the thing is, though, that, somebody who is a ghostwriter, as opposed to being a credited songwriter, the reason you end up being a ghostwriter is because you weren't going to be a star. Like, you could put some words together, you can put a flow together, mm-hmm. but you're not going to sound like Drake. And that's what the issue comes down to, I think.
But could it just be a product of happenstance?
Yeah, like, you could have been there and had a good idea.
That's what I'm saying. You could have been there, or also look, maybe the reason Drake was never a ghostwriter is because who was he going to ghostwrite for? Chaclair?
Yeah.
Maestro Freshwess? Like literally, who was he going to? There was no built-in system. I actually think, in a weird way, what we think of as ghostwriting in the '90s term doesn't exist anymore. What does exist is like your man's man. Who's like in the studio, mm-hmm. the beat's playing, and like the famous person is like puzzling through a rhyme, and then your man's man says, you should say this. And then all of a sudden you've ghostwritten a bar on some big song.
Exactly.
That's very different from like Sauce Money writing a song for Puff.
And being commissioned to do so, as right. opposed to like being in the studio hanging out with a glass right. of Hennessy or whatever.
Right.
A cup, I should say. It's,
yes. much, so it's much more fluid now. So this idea of ghostwriting, and again, we don't know as far as the Quentin Miller stuff, like we don't know where in the process that stuff arrives from.
Right.
We don't know if it's midway, day one, or day 12. Like, we just don't know. I wonder if, is Meek the only guy who's not doing this? You know what I mean? Like, it's sort of like being surprised at, like, bad weather. You're just like, nah, I have the app. Like, I knew the thing was coming. Like, is he the only guy that doesn't have Dark Sky? Like, is he the only one?
I mean, he's been accused, too. Someone came out the other day and said he'd written a couple songs for Meek. So there's no... I can't remember who it was off the top of my head. It was someone that I wasn't familiar with.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But it's just, I guess, Meek comes from a completely different environment that I think he's, in many ways, he's a complete anomaly in 2015. And maybe he is a little bit insulated from the way things have become standardized. You know, he's hanging out in Philly. He was, like, not allowed to leave the state. Like,
mm-hmm. right.
you know, he's not necessarily hanging out in the same way that somebody like Drake is.
But as a fan, I want there to be Meeks. Like,
yeah.
I want there to be mm-hmm. MCs who are ready to fight and battle at the drop of a dime because they feel like they can really bring it and they'll do it in all of the dirty sort of rap battle ways where you're trying to sucker punch people with, you know, mm-hmm. stuff about their mother or whatever it is. And I want there to be a distinction between them and the super pop megastar mm-hmm. crossover, no genre, multimedia, mm-hmm. Future corporate darlings of the world like a Drake or a Kanye. But then you kind of start thinking, like, what are the different ways that, like, Kanye does it? Like, there is camp, beautiful, dark, twisted fantasy
right.
in Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
But that, to me, doesn't seem like a group of ghostwriters. That's a
collaborator.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's like in the 60s, you'd bring in all these session musicians and you sort of give them some direction. And you'd say, well, let's make this kind of record and sort of see what comes out.
Right.
That's what that is, or at least that's what it seems like. But also, let's be honest, at Camp Dark Twisted Fantasy, and we may never know the answer to this, mm-hmm. but like my feeling is like Justin Vernon of Bon Iver shows up and does one thing.
Yeah.
Rick Ross shows up and does another thing. Sci-Hi the Prince, on the other hand, shows up and I'm not totally sure.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like,
but then at the end of the day, Kanye gets to leave Hawaii and is looked at as an auteur in a way that Drake is not. And I don't know if it's because Kanye encapsulates, you know, like Kanye also is interested in visuals and all these other mm-hmm. things that make him out to be the sort of grand artist that mm-hmm. we want him to be. But Drake isn't really that. Like, Drake is a singular artist in mm-hmm. a way that I think makes it a little bit more difficult to, like, let him get away with the ghostwriting.
Do you think, though, that because Kanye also has 5 or 6 years on Drake in
yeah.
terms of career arc, and this is something that I tried to talk about in writing about OVO, is sort of watching Kanye versus Pharrell and being like, well, there's two, I mean, not the only two options, but there's two options. And, like, if you're going to pick one, which one would you pick? And, like, old Drake maybe would have picked Pharrell.
Yeah.
But, like, definitely watching Pharrell on that stage, I was like, yo, don't pick Pharrell.
But, I mean, Pharrell had his own sort of, you know, influence situation come about last year, too, or earlier this
sure.
year, too.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, is anyone really safe at this point, right? Like, you know, it's like nothing's really new. So it just really depends on what you want from your artist. And like Minya said, you want something from Drake that you don't necessarily want from Meek, or that Meek can't
right.
deliver. And on the flip side, Meek can deliver something that Drake simply cannot. And I think, too, that's the difference between Pharrell and Kanye on the same level.
I think Kanye and Drake are similar in that they're probably the best A&Rs in the game. They are like the Sonny Vaqueros of mm-hmm. music. They can
spot the talent.
Talent, whether it's mm-hmm. Sampa or whether it's
McConan,
Little Dragon
yeah.
or McConan mm-hmm. or Future or mm-hmm. Young Thug, and they can immediately hear it and like just build something incredible. I do think, though, it's unfair that when, you know, Drake fans are trying to like dismiss this beef or dismiss what Meek was saying before mm-hmm. he kind of dropped the ball a little bit, they would just say, well, he's just like Kanye. And I think that they do seem different in their process.
Drake is, to me, very vampiric. You know, like he spots
yeah.
talent young. He puts a mark on it. He puts a bite on the
right.
talent. He's like, I'm going to get on your song. You're going to get on my song. I'm going to remix your song.
Which is the J. That's
yeah.
the Jay-Z.
It's the Jay-Z mode. Very savvy. Because
super savvy.
Not only are you aligning yourself with effectively the person who's there to take you out, you're also and sort of endearing yourself to their fans, you're also building up loyalty.
Yeah.
You're also being like, okay, well, basically
and neutralizing
every
them.
basically every interesting rapper who could come from my title owes me something.
Yeah, and you're giving yourself permission to sort of borrow from them too, right? So for instance, if Drake had come out after Migos using their flow, it would have been one thing, but because he got on the Versace remix, it gave him permission to do that in a way that
those are my boys.
Important. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
There was I'm remembering a Kanye moment when Kanye sampled, like, Baltimore Club was kind of a thing, and Kanye worked with DJ Class.
Yeah.
I remember someone saying that this was maybe in a piece somewhere, I'm not even sure, but like when Class was in the studio, like, Kanye was like, "Oh, these drums, like, I love these drums. Like, I want to use these drums." Mm-hmm. And like, part of having Class there is like, "Oh, I can use these drums because you're here." And then maybe once you're not here, maybe I can continue to use these drums. Like, that's maybe still a thing. It's strategically, like you say, it's a J thing. It's strategically very, very savvy. I feel like if I have a counter argument to that, I think Drake really likes rap.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, did you see the thing that that Chief Keef put on Instagram the other day? It's like a quick thing of Drake rapping in a club some Keef song that, like, I actually not even sure what Keef song it is because there's like 700. But
the fact that he knew that song?
Yeah. Right. Just some, like, and he's just like, he's not rapping it to a camera. He's like being caught unawares, just super rapping a random Chief Keef song.
Which to me is kind of similar to you following Chief Keef on Instagram. That is very similar. That shows that John truly loves drill.
But Kanye does the same thing too. Right? Like
three.
When Kanye was in Paris hanging from a rafter, singing along to Young Stoner, I think it was.
Yeah.
You know, that was a big moment for Thug too. But the benefit goes both ways, and I don't think we can necessarily reach a conclusion either way. I think it's just important to notice the fact that, you know, when Drake is out DJing a party and he plays like Cousin Stiz or whomever, that's a big moment too.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think it's necessarily a good or a bad thing. It's
you
just
know who else is
happening.
Really good at those moments? Nicki Minaj. This is, okay.
One element.
We haven't really talked about Nicki.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm not the type to like put a bounty out on things in the world, but I feel like I would pay to see Nicki and Drake's text messages from the last like 3 weeks. Or private emails or what? Like, I want to know, what are the back channel conversations like?
I don't know.
Like?
Are they happening? I just keep thinking about that line that he opened that was on the intro of Nothing Was the Same, where he talks about him and Nicki not speaking, and I just wonder if, you know, maybe we're in a repeat.
Or maybe it's one side, and maybe it's just him texting. It's all on the left side. On
her phone.
Like,
it's all blue. It's all blue.
Yeah, it's all just like every 2 or 3 days.
Yeah.
You know,
and she doesn't have that preference where you can see whether she's received it. Like,
no read receipts or not, read receipts or not. But don't you kind of wonder, because it's interesting that of all the people who Meek Mill is the most aligned with at this moment, it's like, look, who are his alliances? There's Ross. Who we know is a fabulist. And then there's Nicki, who is a pop star collaborator, but who also like argues in favor of like writing your own bars.
Yeah.
But also is like formerly very close friends and maybe still close friends with Drake. Like and obviously co-signs his approach to songwriting.
But I think too that definitely. But I think also Nicki's, you know, continual insistence on writing your own bars is a way to protect yourself as a woman, right? Because if you're a female rapper out here, nobody believes you write your own rhymes, right? So whether she might have been in the studio collaborating with Safari, but she can't really acknowledge that. Even if he contributed one bar, she can't really acknowledge that, because it gives, you know, men out here, and I guess some women too, ammunition to completely rip her to shreds for something that's not
fair.
She's
always proudly stated, "I write my own rhymes," and that's been her distinction from all of the rest of the females who might like come at her. And I think that when it comes to the discussion about ghostwriters, no one even mentions the women that much, because everybody just assumes that all women, like, we all know that yes, people wrote for Foxy, Nas wrote for Foxy, and we know that
Big wrote for Kim,
Big wrote for Kim, and G-Rap wrote for Salt and Pepper. No one even, that's not part of the ghostwriting controversy, which is sad. You know what I mean?
Sure. Although Nicki is actually the complete inversion of that, where you listen to Nicki and she's so sui generis that you're just like, well, who could possibly?
Right.
If someone rapped this well, I would know who that person is.
Exactly.
I would know someone who could rap like that, because there's no way that an anonymous person is doing what she's
doing. And
that's
why it's definitely not
Safari.
Do people think that? Is that a thing in the world?
I hear that all the time. Yes. And it's like when I went to her Brooklyn show the other day, and she was like, how could he write my rhymes? Like, he doesn't even have my vocabulary. Like, he doesn't know how to pronounce
these
words.
It's so
But people really believe these things out here.
But that's the other reason why when people say that, oh, well, Meek is done and there's all these, you know, the memes are all like him being carried out in a coffin and all these other things. I don't believe that anyone can be done because there's people who believe that Cassidy still won. There's people who still think mm-hmm. that Ether wasn't better. There's still people who think that Safari, you know, had great punchlines. And he's like the nicest person. But no, like that's yeah. not an even battle.
Mm-hmm.
There's still fans for everyone. And it's like.
Even losers.
Yeah, there's no such thing. Yeah, there's no such thing as a permanent loser.
Yeah. I mean, Meek might never get on Ellen now, but people are going to buy his records and go to his shows. Like.
Like, Ellen is going to take sides? You know, like.
I don't know. I just, like, I feel like the only two options right now for Meek are, like, you basically, like, this week sometime release, like, the equivalent of, like, a Mobb Deep album. Like, the hardest, darkest, okay. most rugged thing possible. Not even necessarily aiming at Drake. Only obliquely aiming at Drake. But you just basically completely reestablish your bona fides.
Okay.
And you're just like, I'm this guy. And, like, if you like this, then you're riding with me, and it doesn't matter what just happened, that I completely got pantsed
yeah.
for the last, like, 3 weeks. Or you should, like, go to Barbados for, like, 2 months and just, like, disappear, like, deactivate his Instagram. And,
yeah.
And then just, like, come
and then
back.
What?
Then come, we'll come back in, like, December or January and just basically be like, I'm just going to try, I'm going to, like, try and make a radio record now.
So what yeah. does Roc Nation do?
I mean,
you mean, what do they advise him to do? Like, what do they tell him to do? Like, if
no,
you were.
What do they do? Like, do you cut your ties with somebody? Or do
no, I think they can't. I
they
think
must
they
have
can't.
Hired some sort of crisis management company by now. Like, Meek hasn't tweeted in days.
Well, but Miss Info's sitting right here. So, obviously, they didn't hire the crisis manager.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, he did do the teeth bleaching Instagram
oh
in the
God,
midst
insane.
Of all of the.
What do you
wait,
make?
What,
you
was
make,
that?
What do you make? Do you make, like, what, $1,000, $2,000 for that post? Like, what do you make for that?
Like,
why would you do that?
Must have been a
doesn't he read? Doesn't he read Jezebel?
Yeah.
Like Jezebel just did a whole thing on
like,
Instagram
what's next?
Promoted
like, waist
posts.
Trainers? Like,
oh my gosh! So the last question
yeah.
is: this done? And by done, I don't mean like are the back and forths done? Because I think there'll be subs and there'll be little things here and there. Like it's never totally done. But whatever hit Drake could have taken, has it been established that it hit him and it bounced off? And Drake is basically. Still at the top, still untouchable. Does this affect the arc of Drake's career in any material way?
You know, I might be part of the problem, but I, at the end of it all, and I openly admit, no matter who takes the L this week and who, you know, gets a W next week, it's not going to stop me from listening to both and enjoying
mm-hmm.
both artists.
Mm-hmm.
Primarily because I only pick the things that I like anyway. So, like, I'm only listening
from,
to yeah.
Right,
it could come
from anywhere.
It could be the album that they, you know, it could be Take Care,
mm-hmm.
and I'll just be listening to that. And I'm not attaching it to whatever's happening.
The
right
larger
now.
Narrative.
I think that the ghostwriting issue is a big one, but I don't think that I can apply it to consistently
across.
To any real artist because I think that everyone is sort of hypocritical.
Well, I don't disagree with that.
Yeah,
for sure. What do you think, Raleigh?
I think that Drake. You know, is always going to have access to a certain infrastructure that's going to keep him at the W. But I think at the end of the day, there is going to be some sort of larger conversation about the narrative of hip hop that is going to be more important than Drake. You know, and I think that's something
that this will trigger. That.
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is going to be like, you know, and I think when we look back at it in hindsight, it's going to be considered to be some sort of breaking point in hip hop. Or at least new languages in the way we talk about hip hop.
And
I think that something new is going to happen that we won't, you know, maybe down the line we'll reconvene and talk about it. But for now, it's just clear to me that there's like some sort of shift that's happening.
And like we have to come up with a new word instead of ghostwriter.
Yeah, like not even just like ghostwriter, but also hip hop and rapper mm-hmm. and all of these
right.
things that are based on social mm-hmm. and cultural and racial and class binaries that don't necessarily exist anymore, I think are being exploded in a way that Drake's been doing since the beginning of his career, but I think this is a hallmark moment for that.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the Drake and Meek Mill battle, it's about comfort versus struggle. It's about street versus middle class or alleged middle class. You
yeah,
know,
it's about Nicki Minaj.
It's about Nicki Minaj. It's about Nicki Minaj. Judd Nicki, who wrote a couple pieces, like she wrote a thing a few months ago about colorism in hip hop.
Yeah.
You know, it's about that. Like
right,
it's about hip hop and R&B. It's about all these things that are wars that have been waged for many, many years, but maybe are less relevant today. And I think the thing you're saying about language, I don't think that the language has evolved. Like, sometimes I'll be writing a piece and I say rapper, or I say, and I know, or even better, like, I call something a hip hop album, and then like someone on Twitter will be like, that's not hip hop.
It's a it's a mixtape.
Right.
Yeah, all kinds of things. But I think a lot of those conversations come to a head in Drake, and that's why it's so easy to talk about him for so long. It's why I have a podcast that's only about Drake, because all of these different things that have been... I try.
Drake
issues? It's called Trust Issues.
Okay. Yeah. Find it on SoundCloud and iTunes, if you so desire. But no, I think that's one of the things that makes him so interesting and why we're talking about him right now is that it's all of these converging things that are in one person, like mixtape versus album, like, you know, black versus whatever else, like closeness to proximity to whiteness, like all these kinds of things. And I think, you know, this is the beginning of the conversation, not the end of it.
He is like, I mean, he is genuinely post-binary in almost every imaginable way. And it's got to be enraging for a certain generation who literally just lived and died, sometimes actually died by binaries, to see someone who basically so effortlessly floats above them. That's got to be a real challenge. And I think this is where, to circle back to the beginning, we were saying about Meek and Meek's relationship to hip-hop and what hip-hop did for Meek. Look, Meek may or may not know Drake's struggle, and we may or may not know what Drake's struggles really are, but Meek certainly conceives of his struggle and hip-hop's relationship to it as very different than Drake's struggle and hip-hop's relationship to that. And that, like, ultimately, maybe it's about Nicki Minaj, but it's also about the sort of, like, politics of what you use that art form for. And I think Meek is kind of like, no, it's for this. And Drake is like, you've literally missed 20 years of evolution, bro. It's for that, but it's for 50 other things also.
Which is also, like, that could be part of the technology gap. There's so many different things that are socioeconomic
structural stuff.
I think one definite thing that, along with, like, new words that need to be invented, the bottom line is you have to treat your ghostwriters really well.
Absolutely.
Because wherever this started, or wherever the actual reference tracks came from,
has a name. It has a name and a Twitter account, and it could go haywire. And also, if it can go haywire for Drake, it can go haywire for anyone.
Exactly.
Like, there's got to be a lot of people deleting. Like, it's like Hillary Clinton's State Department emails. Yeah. It's a lot of people on private servers deleting stuff.
Yeah. Like, if Drake doesn't let you into his house with a cell phone, you should not be able to leave his studio with reference tracks.
Let me tell you just one little insight: is that when King Kunta came out, there were definitely artists, and possibly artists that are now involved in these issues, who were wondering whether that was about them. So that the fact that Kendrick can say something about ghostwriters, and multiple huge megastars can be like, is he talking about me? And that he could be talking about them because people are having those conversations behind the scenes, means if you're going to have anybody working on your team, you got to make sure that they're happy all the time. And, you know, Kanye sees that all the time with people getting mad. Khan's getting mad at him. Now Sahai's mad at him. You know, so it's trying to keep everybody happy forever.
Like, everything we've just said is all, I think, accurate and, like, provocative and correct. And yet there's something strange that I think has happened with this particular beef where, weirdly, because Drake is coming out with Teflon, like basically untouched, in a weird way, this guy who has premised his entire career upon dismantling binaries, being post-categorization, has weirdly reified the old category. He's the tough guy. He's the Don. He's the king. He's on top. He's not the greatest rapper. But he is the guy. And hip hop has always been obsessed with whether the greatest rapper or who the king of the genre is. I was looking at a cover of an old XXL, and it was like Jay-Z, presidential MC. And you're just like, okay, we're just like running out of adjectives at a certain point. But like, we've always been obsessed with like what the hierarchy is. Drake's a guy who literally got to the top by completely ignoring and sidestepping But weirdly, now that he's at the top, isn't he just sort of behaving like everybody else who's been at the top? That's something that I think about. And then you wonder if, like, is the thing that was special about Drake, does that get lost because there's no nuance at the top? Once you're at the top, it's very hard to be nuanced. You're preoccupied with, like, maintaining your power on some Game of Thrones stuff. So
the nuance is now future.
Right.
Because totally he's true. Above. Mm-hmm. He's, like, above it all. But then maybe Drake is now affirming that he wants a crown, that proverbial crown.
Well, I think he has the crown. Yeah. I mean, I think he has it and has had it, but is
has
is
it
he,
versus Jay-Z and Kanye? Like, has
I think
it
in 2015, okay. Absolutely. I think probably since 2013, if we're being super honest.
Right. Yeah.
I feel like the crown has been his. The question is, in order to maintain the crown, does it require a different approach than what it took to get you there? And I think that's the test, like,
yeah.
Tough Drake era, yeah. That's the test. And it's why I was intrigued to see that all the recent songs, and I think I said this in the piece, even the diss songs, they're not angry.
No, they're
like 10 bands
back.
And Energy,
yeah.
And
yep.
Legend, like, those are angry records. Those are anxious, stressed records. These new songs, like, whether it's Charged Up or whether it's Hotline Bling, they're just like, I'm just in the cup, man. Like, I'm just like, hey.
I'm on Mount Olympus.
It's
the time,
like,
of his life. And
cool.
In the same way that Jay-Z is always going to rap about the fact that he's from Marcy and he sold drugs, Drake is always going to rap about the fact that he made it against the odds. And mm-hmm. That's what, his crowning doesn't exist without that context. And that's always going to be a part of it. So he's always going to be patting himself on the back for it.
Right. You just begin to wonder if 2 years at the top or 5 years at the top or however many years his run is going to be, at a certain point, is he not necessarily a parody of himself,
yeah.
But a parody of top rapperdom.
Yeah.
Like, is there a way to maintain being at the top without kind of falling into the same traps that every other rapper has been?
I think the only thing, though,
ones.
Is that he's going to move on. He's going to be making films. He's going to be doing all
yes.
kinds of things in a way that other
he'll
rappers just
he'll
could
tap
do.
Out.
Yeah,
so basically he'll
tap out when he's on top. Yeah.
Thank you guys so much for being here. This has been a mind-bending conversation.
We could go on for hours and
we
hours.
Could,
and hours.
Forever.
We could absolutely do it. Let's go out. Let's go out with a real chill Drake record.
Okay. Well,
what's like Hotline Bling? Maybe.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Let's go out with Hotline Bling. Which to me, what I was excited about Hotline Bling is that it's basically like a 2011 Drake record,
yeah.
Sort of just slipped into all the madness of 2015. So let's go out with Hotline Bling.
You used to call me on my cell phone. Late night when you need my love. Call me on my cell phone. Late night when you need my love. I know when that hotline bling, that can only mean one thing. I know when that hotline bling, that can only mean one thing. Ever since I left the city,
thank you so much for listening to the New York Times podcast. Thank you to Minya O and Rawia Kamir. You can subscribe to the podcast at iTunes. Check out our Spotify playlist. You can read Rawia and the work of Minya on ArtsBeat on nytimes.com/music, as well as what I have written about Drake and OVO and the ethics of ghostwriting. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and we will be back next week. Trust me, Daddy.